Good morning and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. It is Wednesday, April 13th, 2022. We are ready now for oral argument on the second case set on today's calendar in the matter of the contested case hearing request by W. Lorenz and Sons Construction. I waited until the appointed time. I believe we have as many people online as are interested in observing today's argument. Counsel, I'll just remind each of you that you will have 15 minutes to present your argument. Counsel for relator, you will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal should you choose to use it. It is important that you state your name and identify the party that you represent at the beginning of your argument. And just a reminder to everyone that video recordings of the Zoom session are not permitted. So with that, counsel for relator, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court and counsel. My name is Matthew Berger. I'm appearing today on behalf of relator W. Lorenz and Sons Construction. The relevant facts in this case are quite simple. On December 1 of 2020, the MPCA granted coverage to W. Lorenz and Sons Construction under a general NPDES SDS industrial stormwater permit. 10 days later, with no prior notice to Lorenz and no opportunity for Lorenz to be heard, the agency unilaterally revoked coverage under that permit. W. Lorenz and Sons promptly, despite the lack of notice, requested a contested case hearing. And after delaying 9 months, the agency denied that request. W. Lorenz and Sons Construction challenges these two decisions based on the fact that the agency regulations establish clear and mandatory procedures that must be followed for revoking a permit, and because both the decision to revoke the permit and the decision to deny a contested case proceeding were arbitrary and capricious. I'm going to begin with the procedural issues in this case. Under the Administrative Procedures Act, this court may reverse a decision of an administrative agency if that decision is made upon unlawful procedure in violation of constitutional provisions or is affected by other error of law. All of these bases apply to the procedural problems in this case, and I'm going to address them as a group because they are all intertwined. The MPCA has adopted specific administrative rules that govern permits. They govern permit applications, public comment periods, issuance of permits, and importantly, revocation of permits. As it relates to revocation of permits, these procedures are mandatory, and they are set forth in Minnesota Rules 7001.0190, subpart 4. And I'm quoting, "The commissioner shall give notice to the permittee of a proposal to revoke a permit without reissuance. This notice must state that within 30 days of the receipt of the notice, the permittee may request a contested case hearing be held on the proposed action. If the permittee requests a contested case hearing, the agency shall hold the hearing in accordance with the rules of the Office of Administrative Hearings," and then there's a reference to particular rules. This rule specifically uses the terms shall and must.
So, counsel, I apologize for interrupting you, and I do want to compliment you and counsel for the MPCA for so clearly laying out the relevant rules, regulations, and statutes in the case, which, you know, is contained in your briefing, and the court is well aware of it. I want to perhaps back you up just a little bit, because you outlined what you thought were the relevant facts in the case, and I just want to make sure that I understand your position on some facts that you did not mention. So I guess the first one I would mention is that at the time that the MPCA issued approval of Lorenz as having coverage under the NPDES permit at that time, there was an EAW petition pending, right, that had been submitted to the EQB?
Your Honor, we do not know that from the administrative record before the court. And I want to dig down on this because I believe this is critical.
I'm sorry, I did not see that. I mean, that is specifically laid out in the findings of fact by the MPCA. So are you now contesting those factual findings? Because I didn't see that argument in your brief, or maybe I'm misunderstanding.
Yeah, Your Honor, I want to break it down because I think that this is critical. So we are not contesting that a petition requesting an EAW was filed on November 9 of 2020. We are not disputing that the permit was granted on December 1, 2020. I do not believe that the agency is disputing that also on December 1, 2020, the Cottonwood County Board of Commissioners voted to deny the petition. At the time they voted to deny the petition, they were the designated responsible governmental unit. What's not now, in our administrative...
Council, I just have to have you pause for just a second here, because there are specific findings by the MPCA about that Cottonwood County vote, right? And it includes what you said, but it also includes that Cottonwood County stated that that was not a final vote and that they would be taking a final vote later. December 15th was the schedule. So you're overlooking that fact.
Your Honor,
I think more fundamentally, and I just want to, again, we have such a limited amount of time to talk. The other relevant, I think, facts, law here are that the EQB did decide that when it appointed Cottonwood County as an RGU, it had done so mistakenly. And I'll just use the word mistake, all right? That in fact, Cottonwood County could not be appointed as an RGU under relevant provisions because it had already made a final decision. It had approved a COP, right, for Lawrence?
Yes.
And so it was not eligible to be an RGU. And Lawrence was given notice of that. I don't have the exact date, or maybe I do, December 11th, I think. EQB notifies everyone, the parties, Cottonwood County. I don't see that you dispute that finding or discussion in by the MPCA in the record.
Your Honor, I would say that the record does not establish the timing of those two things. And I have a little bit different nuance on the county's actions that I think is critical.
Well what about the law, counsel? I mean, the law appears to me, reading the briefs and then having read the underlying law, it seems to be pretty clear that Cottonwood County was not able to proceed as RGU in this case. That was a decision made by the EQB. You didn't challenge it. This court is going to accept it. You need to tell me otherwise why I would view it otherwise.
Your Honor, I do not believe, and I am not aware of any case law that addresses a situation where a responsible governmental unit is designated by the EQB and acts during the time while it was designated, and it is later determined to have been improperly designated.
You're overlooking the part that Cottonwood County specifically stated it had not taken a final vote.
Your Honor, that was the nuance that I wanted to turn to.
All right. I'm sorry. I'll stop interrupting you. Go right ahead. Yeah.
And that nuance is I do not agree that Cottonwood County said it had not taken a final vote. What Cottonwood County's action was to take a vote and then to come back to adopt the formal written findings to support the decision that it had made on December 1. And that's commonly done in zoning proceedings where a county board holds a hearing, they make a decision, they ask staff to go back and prepare written findings, and they adopt them at their next meeting. And that is what it appears was done in this case. Not that it wasn't a final action, but that they were waiting to adopt the written findings to support that action. And I think that that fact is supported by the fact that on December 7th, before that action had occurred, the county attorney notified the EQB of the county's action. So the county was not treating this as not having been a final action. They, in fact, notified the EQB before adopting written findings that they had acted.
So, counsel, just two quick questions for you, and then I will let you finish. I realize you've only got 5 minutes remaining, although we always look forward to everything you want to tell us. So paragraph 18 of the MPCA's decision says that on December 11th, Cottonwood County informed the EQB that a vote by Cottonwood County Board of Commissioners to approve the denial of the petition would not take place until Tuesday, December 15th. Cottonwood County requested that the EQB refrain from publishing notices of its decision, which was, it's referring to an earlier paragraph, its decision, EQB's, was that Cottonwood County was not eligible to proceed as an RGU. So just, there's no challenge in your brief to that factual finding in the record. And, it troubles me that you're now appearing to me to rest your entire argument on something that I don't see in your brief. So if you would address that narrow question, and then, I'll let you wrap up your argument.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, but I think that the actual administrative record contains contradictory facts on that point. Frankly, that's part of the reason that a contested case hearing may be appropriate here. But I would not say I'm resting my entire argument on that point, because even if that were true, even if this court were to accept those facts as outlined, the rules, the procedures required in Minnesota Rules 7001.0190, subpart 4, do not create an exception for that. In fact, if that is a basis for revocation, that is identified in Rule 7001.0180 as a basis for revocation, if there was a mistake of fact. And in that case, the procedures are still required. It's still a permit revocation. And when the agency is going to revoke a permit, without exception, without qualification, Subpart 4 of Minnesota Rules 7001.0190 requires the MPCA to follow procedural notice and hearing requirements to make sure that these issues can be fleshed out and addressed before they revoke.
Counsel, if we agree that the rule you just cited does not apply to people who submit applications to fall under a general permit, that indeed the rule only applies to people seeking an individual permit, what becomes of your argument?
Your Honor, if the court were to find in that way, then we would be resting on the arbitrary and capricious argument and not the procedure. If I may address, I do not believe that that's an appropriate interpretation of the rule, but I want to clearly answer your question that if the court found that way, then the procedural issues would not apply and we'd be looking arbitrary and capricious.
But counsel, how do you respond to the fact that that Rule 7001.0010 creates definitions for permit and general permit that are different? And I think it's undisputed that your client, the relator, was seeking coverage under a general permit. I mean, don't the different definitions, in fact, support the agency's application of the procedural rule?
No, Your Honor. And if we look at those actual definitions, I believe it is clear that a general permit is a subset of a permit. So a permit, that term is a broader term, which encompasses, but is not limited to, a general permit. And I think that that understanding, that interpretation is clear from the definition of a general permit, which begins, general permit means a permit. So the definition of general permit refers to a permit as something broader than just a general permit. So I think the rule we're talking about here uses the broader term, permit. And that's defined as discharge, emission, and disposal authorization. If you look at the coverage document that's in the record for coverage under this permit, and I am at addendum 11, it calls itself a permit on its face. It refers to a permittee. It has a permit number, but most critically for that definition, addendum 14, line 1.2, this permit authorizes stormwater discharges associated with industrial activity for any primary SIC code and or narrative activities, and it continues. The permit authorizes a discharge. It is a permit as part of that broader definition. And so that is why, and I see I'm just about out, if I may finish this thought briefly.
You may.
That's why this distinction, what the agency is attempting to do, to carve out a distinction between individual permits and general permits. Permit itself is a broad term. The only way the agency can get to that interpretation is by reading the word individual into subpart 4 of 7001.0190. The word individual simply doesn't appear there. So that they're attempting to change through argument, through administrative action, the plain language of their own regulation, and they cannot manufacture ambiguity in that way.
Thank you, Council. Thank you. You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Council for respondent, you may proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. My name is Pete Farrell. I'm an Assistant Attorney General, and I represent the respondent, the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, in this appeal. I'm going to start this morning by laying out the affirmative reasons this court should affirm the agency's decision, and then I'll respond to some of the specific arguments that were raised by counsel for Lorentz this morning. This case is about the MPCA acting promptly and decisively to correct a permitting error so the environmental review process could be completed. This court should affirm the MPCA's decision to deny Lorentz's request for a contested case hearing and the underlying permit revocation for three reasons. First, a permit issued based on a mistake of fact and in violation of the law is void from the outset and may be revoked immediately. Second, if the permit were not void, MPCA reasonably determined that the procedural rule Lorentz is relying on, Rule 7001.0190 subpart 4, did not apply in this context, the context of auto-issued coverage under a general industrial stormwater permit. Finally, even if the court disagrees with the MPCA on either of those two points, this court should still affirm because any error here was harmless. Lorentz's substantial rights have not been prejudiced. Let me start with the void ab initio rule and why it applies in this case. The rule in Minnesota is that a permit issued based on a fact,
If I may, I want to, again, compliment you as I did Mr. Berger. The briefing in this was quite thorough with regard to what the landscape is on the law and the rules and regulations. And we have read that and very much appreciate the detailed discussion. So I'd like to, if I could, just move ahead a bit. I see your reliance on the case law for mistake of fact and law. As I read that case law, and maybe I missed something, it doesn't say that the permit is void, does it? What's the language in the case law?
So Howard says is a permit that's issued based on a mistake of fact or contrary to law confers no privileges on the permittee. It vests no right. I think that's the exact language. It confers no privileges on the permittee. And then in that same paragraph, what it says is if the government learns that the permit is issued based on a mistake of fact and contrary to some law, it may be revoked immediately. That's what Howard says.
Right. And I think if I read those cases correctly, the courts upheld revocations that occurred without hearings. And I'm trying to recall if the revocation also occurred without notice. Can you help me on that?
Yes, in some of the cases, Your Honor, they occurred without notice. There's a discussion of that in Snyder, which is the City of Minneapolis building permit case from 1989. There, the City of Minneapolis revoked that permit without any pre-deprivation notice or hearing. The court affirmed the revocation in that case. I think in the Minnesota cases, Judge Bratfold, the word void does not appear. I'd agree with you there, but I think that is the necessary implication of what the rule is. And I'd also direct the court to the Fourth Circuit's decision, which, while not binding on this court, I do think is persuasive. It's a 2018 decision involving a suspension of an erroneously issued permit. And in that case, the Fourth Circuit surveyed the landscape, looked at cases from across the country, including Howard and Snyder. And the way the Fourth Circuit articulated the rule is that when you have these two criteria, a mistake of fact and a violation of law, something that goes to the defect, something that renders the permit fundamentally defective, it is void ab initio. It is void from the outset. That's why you can revoke it without any
pre-deprivation. Counsel, I appreciate that the case law talks about mistake of fact and mistake of law. I was troubled that in your brief, you did not discuss the rule that now I hear Mr. Berger pointing out, which is that the MPCA has as a grounds for revocation any reliance on a failure to if a permit is issued based on a failure to disclose or some sort of false or misleading information. That's actually a ground for revocation. Now, I appreciate that your overall position is that those revocations, and that got discussed in the opening remarks, that those revocation rules don't apply here and reasons for that. But just assuming they do apply, it seems to me that that lays out a pretty clear path for the MPCA to not go the route that you're now saying, which is, oh, it's just void. It doesn't, you know, the permit didn't matter. It was issued in error. We're just going to pull it. It seems that you had very clear rules suggesting that no, you would proceed to revoke it for these reasons, mistakes of fact. So what do we do? How do we interpret the case law in light of those rules that have been adopted?
Two responses, Your Honor. First of all, the rule that Mr. Berger cited in oral argument this morning does not go to the mistake of law error here. The fact that under MEPA, under the Minnesota Environmental Policy Act, the agency was precluded as a matter of law from issuing a permit while the citizen petition was pending. So I don't think the rule addresses that issue, that fundamental defect in the permit. Second of all, that leads right into the agency's, and obviously Your Honor already signaled this, so I'm not going to repeat myself. If the permit's void, we don't think any of these rules apply when you have that fundamental defect. But even if the court were to disagree with me on that, the rule that Mr. Berger is relying on doesn't apply in this context because we are dealing with auto-issued coverage under a general permit. And MPCA concluded in its order that that sequence of rules, basically, so you've got the 7001.0190 and 7001.0180, which were the grounds that Mr. Berger were talking about. Those rules are really designed to deal with individual permits. And that makes sense when you look at the permitting scheme as a whole. It makes sense that in the context of an individual permit, you're going to have more back-end protection because there's a lot of front-end process to make sure that these types of permitting errors don't happen. So with an individual permit, typically, the agency is going to issue a draft permit. That's going to be put on public notice. There's going to be an opportunity for public comment. There's going to be an opportunity for the public to petition for a contested case hearing, a discretionary contested case hearing. And in that circumstance, if MPCA is going to yank a permit because of noncompliance or some sort of misleading information, then it makes sense that on the back end, the individual permittee is going to have more rights. But that just simply doesn't map onto this situation where you have auto-issued coverage under a general permit.
If I can just ask you to pause for a second, that's a helpful explanation for how these things proceed. But here's what I... trying to make sure I read your brief correctly. So you've given us your view that these revocation rules do not apply, the general individual permit dichotomy, the auto issuance, things like that. So that is, as I understand your argument, that's the agency's interpretation of the rules, and you are conceding that the rules themselves are ambiguous. Am I right about that?
You are correct about that. Okay. We think that the...
Is this court bound by your view that the rules are ambiguous?
I think that under the prevailing framework, most recently articulated by the Minnesota Supreme Court in U.S. Steel and Justice Thiessen's decision, the framework is this. If the court is confronted with an ambiguous regulation, and here we think the regulation is ambiguous for the reasons laid out in our brief, reasons of silence, structure, and text, then the question becomes whether the agency's interpretation is reasonable. And in making
that— So you're saying we need to accept your view that the rules are ambiguous?
Yes. I think you have to accept the— I think that's the way that the analytical framework works. You have to conclude that the rule is ambiguous.
And the case you rely on, counsel, just to be clear?
Is U.S. Steel. It's a 2021 decision from the Minnesota Supreme Court where Justice Thiessen was addressing ambiguities in groundwater regulations in Chapter 750 and 7060. And in that case, in an analogous circumstance here, the case is cited in our brief. Basically, the Minnesota Supreme Court was confronted with a regulatory scheme that basically didn't address how groundwater was to be regulated in a certain way. And the court concluded that U.S. Steel's interpretation of the rule was reasonable, but also that the MPCA's interpretation, where it pointed out that the regulations didn't speak to the issue, rendered the rule ambiguous. And then the question for the court became whether the agency's interpretation was in fact reasonable, because the court will uphold agency interpretations of ambiguous regulations so long as they are reasonable. That's when those deference doctrines kick in.
But it sounds like, follow up to Judge Bradfield's initial line of questioning, that the court still makes the decision in applying law whether the rules are in fact ambiguous.
Yes. That is correct. And if the court agrees with the agency that it is ambiguous, then the question, then the rule, the interpretive rule, and this is certainly true in Minnesota, and I still think mostly true at the U.S. Supreme Court level as well, is that if the agency's interpretation is reasonable, it is upheld. That's where deference doctrines kick in. That's what Justice Thiessen says in U.S. Steel. And here, the agency's interpretation should be upheld as reasonable for at least a few reasons. First of all, this is the agency's own administrative rule. And in U.S. Steel, Justice Thiessen notes that's typically entitled to significant deference. Second, this is within the core of the agency's permitting expertise. MPCA administers an enormously complicated water pollution permitting scheme that involves federal and state components, and the agency has expertise in administering these rules. On top of that, and I don't want this to get lost this morning, is the agency's interpretation is consistent with its background obligations under the Minnesota Environmental Policy Act, which prohibit the agency from making this type of decision while a citizen petition for environmental review is pending. So for those reasons, Your Honor, reasons of silence, structure, and text, we think the rule's ambiguous, the agency's interpretation is reasonable, and that would be a basis to affirm. Let me briefly address why I think any error here was harmless, and then I want to hone in on Judge Bradfield's line of questioning about what happened on December 1st and what happened on December 15th, because I do think that's critical. In terms of Lorenz's substantial rights have been prejudiced, the permit was revoked within 10 days. This court only reverses agency decisions made upon unlawful procedure if substantial rights are prejudiced. Our brief walks through the Delhi case where this court affirmed the University of Minnesota's termination decision that didn't follow the procedural rule. There was no prejudice here because the dispositive issue here, and there's been no challenge to this, is that the citizen petition had not been dismissed. It had not been adjudicated because it wasn't properly assigned in the first instance. And therefore, as a matter of law, the MPCA was precluded from issuing the permit on December 1st. So let me then circle back to some of the record-based questions that came up and what happened on December 1st.
Before you go there, counsel, I guess I read your harmless error argument to also depend in part on the fact that Lorenz has not reapplied for a petition. I'm sorry. Yeah. Poor permit. Is that correct? Or am I wrong about that? You seem to now be focused on just that 10 days period and the original MPCA decision to issue the permit, where it seems like the analysis would be different if Lawrence had reapplied. Am I wrong?
I don't think we've focused on their failure to reapply. I do think it's relevant in the sense that had they reapplied, you know, there would have been an application pending in front of the agency, and they would have gotten an up and down decision on the petition within 30 business days. They've chosen not to do that. They've chosen to pursue this appeal. That's their right. But I do think that could potentially factor into the analysis, although that wasn't a focus of the briefing. I do think that is potentially relevant. On the record issue in December 1st and December 15th, the agency is absolutely disputing that what the county did on December 1st was a denial of the petition. There were specific findings on what happened, extensive findings on what happened here. The record is complicated, but ultimately it boils down to this. Even if the court wants to discount everything the state did here, the county did not think its denial was effective as of December 1st. It asked the EQB to hold off on publishing notice. That's in record document number 16. That's corroborated by record document number 12, where the county actually went ahead, even after EQB told them not to do anything, to actually adopt findings of fact. And the reason for that, and I just want to make sure I get this across to the court, the reason for that is under the applicable environmental regulations, the environmental review regulations, 4410.1100 subpart 6, when you deny a petition, you need to make specific findings of fact. There needs to be a record of why. And so I'm not totally sure what the county thought it was doing on December 1st, but the court can absolutely find substantial evidence in the record, which again is the standard of review here, to support the agency's determination that denial was not effective as of December 1st. I see my time has expired. May I briefly conclude?
You may.
For the reasons discussed this morning and the reasons in our brief, this court should affirm the MPCA's decision to deny the contested case hearing request, as well as the underlying permit revocation.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Berger, you will have the last word.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to touch briefly on the discussion about the case law related to prior revocations, in some cases without notice or hearing. There's no discussion that I recall in any of those cases about any specific rules related to those permits that require notice and a hearing or require procedures. So that's fundamentally different than what we have here, where we have a specific agency regulation that uses mandatory language to require procedures for revocation. So that's a fundamental distinction of those prior cases and this case, is the agency has adopted specific procedures here, has made them mandatory, and has not followed them. And that's really what this case is about, is people who apply for permits have expectations and rights. And to say that there's no harm here, Lawrence, in this case, there's no dispute that they, when they got notice that they had the permit, they had all the required permits, the county had acted, they believed had acted to deny their permit, they went out and started work. They relied on the permit and worked for multiple days here. And only stopped when their permit was revoked. So we're left here with a site that's been stripped of topsoil that's been sitting here for years because the agency could not be bothered to follow their own rules, to tell them, we're going to do this.
Thank you, counsel. I do appreciate you explaining that. And it seems to touch on, in part, on the harmless error argument that has been made by the MPCA. Would you more directly address that?
Yes. It's whether the agency could have revoked at the end of this, we don't know until there's a full opportunity for hearing. There may be basis, there may not be. But that's why we have these procedures in the first place. That's why we have these safeguards that citizens can rely on to prevent administrative agencies from running amok, from doing whatever they want.
So, Council, I guess I'm struggling a little bit. I hear the MPCEA to be saying that if it had granted a hearing, it would the fundamental mistake of law would remain, which is that the MPCEA was not authorized to grant the permit at the time it did because the EAW petition was pending. So help me out with that more narrow argument. Okay.
Your Honor, again, factually, I think if we had a hearing, there would be an opportunity to develop the record of the timing and what the county decided or believed it was deciding. Again, Mr. Farrell points to evidence in the record. I point to the fact that the county attorney notified the EQB on December 7th that the county had decided it as evidence that the county thought it was deciding. So that's a record that would be developed from a hearing. I'm troubled to hear that an agency may make conclusions of what an outcome would be before a hearing. I think that's the definition of arbitrary and capricious. I would say it's possible that that's what the outcome would be, but we don't know. And that's why we give people notice and an opportunity to be heard. We don't just leap at outside political influence and act. And this gets back again to the fundamental language in the regulation and the discussion about whether that regulation is ambiguous or not, which is the critical first step. I think it eventually became clear, but I want to be clear. I believe the case law is absolutely clear that whether a regulation is ambiguous is a question of law that goes to this court, and that there is no deference to the agency's determination of ambiguity. Deference only comes in after this court determines that a regulation is ambiguous. And on that point, we can look at the plain language of the regulation. If you look at Chapter 7001, when the agency wants to distinguish between general permits and individual permits, it does so throughout those regulations. It didn't here. It said permit, and that has a defined meaning. With that, may I briefly conclude?
Thank you, Council. Thank you both for your helpful arguments and briefing today. We